I'm Baratunde Thurston, coming to you live from Los Angeles, California, due to the magic of technology. So magical, I just helped my in-laws get set up with their grandkids on a video thing. It involved an iPad, an iPhone, a landline, and a bunch of prayers, so I'm feeling pretty good about tech in this exact moment. Welcome to the third episode of Unfinished Live. This is an interactive digital series where we use your questions to understand the world around us and to explore what's possible now. And for the next hour, we're going to be talking about technology and humanity, the way we connect to each other, the tech industry itself, surveillance, data ownership, trust, privacy, and of course, our shared fear of a robot uprising, as eloquently elucidated by that documentary known as The Terminator. All that good stuff is a part of this show. And speaking of good stuff, we will also look into the awe-inspiring opportunities, the ways that tech can drive progress at an unprecedented scale, not just the fear. This is a massive topic. And it means a lot to me personally because I grew up in a tech-powered house, not a smart home, not like a Jetson, well, like a black Jetson in the hood. My mom was a computer programmer and started doing that in the 1970s. With no college degree. Before that was a really known job you could have. So I lived through the power of technology economically and also creatively, but even more deeply personally. I had the first computer in our house when I was 6 years old. That would predate by 15 years the moment I would ever have a girlfriend in that house. So technology was literally my first love. That's what I'm saying. It's very personal for me. And it's not always a healthy relationship, as so many of us know. Technology gives us, or can take away, a lot of our power, and especially the power to shape the world as we perceive it, as we experience it. So much is mediated by technology and by business models and investment choices and design choices that affect so many of us. So we're looking into, in this episode, does tech contribute to our experience, or does it detract from our humanity? Are these ideas linked, or are they entirely separate? And in the context that we're all living in right now, it's extra important because we're in a pandemic still. And technology has emerged as more consequential than ever. Remember back when we said we were going to unplug? Remember digital detoxes? COVID was like, good luck with that. And now we need this technology to go to work, to go to school, to interact with the people we care about, AKA those in-laws I mentioned earlier. Tech even helps us meditate. And between me and you, it's how we're communicating right now, literally between me and you. So let's warm up that communication. You know, I love to dive into the chat. I will be there with you in a second. For now, you get in there and help us reflect together. Answer me this. How has technology changed your life? That's the deal here at Unfinished. It's not a spectator sport. I don't do monologues by myself. We want you to weigh in. And if you're doing so on social media, weigh in with the tech-powered hashtag of Unfinished Live. We're now going to start with a segment where we ask people on the street a few critical questions about technology. What's good about tech? What do we fear? What must we think about? And after that, we'll head into our regular kind of game of Finished Unfinished, where we ask questions related to tech. Are these ideas over and done? Are they dying? Should they be eliminated, aka finished? Or are they unfinished? Do we still have work to do and more to invest in? And in that segment, we'll hear from two incredible people sharing in that conversation. Tristan Harris is one of them. He's the president of the Center for Humane Technology. Before that, he was the design ethicist at Google, a real job. And some of you may recognize him as a star in the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma. The other participant is Manoush Zomorodi, a journalist and the queen of podcasting. I'm going to confer that title on her right now. Spread it to the world. She explores humanity's relationship with tech through her shows. She's the host of the TED Radio Hour on NPR, and she produces and hosts Zigzag, which is all about being human. Let's get to it.
What scares me about technology?
I think the future of it. I don't know what's going to be. Will people accept it?
Pretty much you can't do anything without a computer. And if you don't have no knowledge of the computer, you lost out here in this world.
I don't know what people are gonna do with it. That's the thing. You don't have any privacy anymore. say something out loud, I don't even Google it, and then all of a sudden I'm getting served ads for it.
There's some people out there who use technology for the wrong reasons.
I worry just about the sheer amount of time spent with your head not in the real world, something out of science fiction to me.
It's addictive, right?
Yes, it is, but it's fun.
Alexa, in which way is technology working? She didn't answer.
I guess there's hope.
There's so many ways that we can use it for good instead of evil.
I think it's led to great medical advances.
It can make lives easier. All types of little problems that you can't do, technology helps you.
You know, when you reach my age, you remember when your family bought a radio. Now you can put your transistor radio in your shirt pocket. Think about it.
I think that's one of the benefits that technology has given us, to broaden our horizon in a way that we couldn't 10, 20 years ago.
We should put our minds to what people are going to do for work in the future and how we can educate people with technology so that they can continue to work.
Hopefully we could draw not only the United States together, but get a better understanding with all the nations of the world, so to speak, to walk in the other guy's shoes for a few steps. I think technology allows us to do that.
My old pal, Tristan Harris, I am so excited to see you.
Good to see you again. Talk
unfinished and finished. And we're going to start with a big one. Tristan, fake news. Is it finished or is it unfinished?
I think fake news is, and the falsification of our information environment is here to stay. I think we need, you know, because I don't think as long as we have business models, as you know, that are about spreading unchecked information virally without any kind of moderation or circuit breakers, that is just dangerously leaves room for fast infection of false information. I think of it like COVID. You know, what's the R-naught of fake information? And as we say in the film, The Social Dilemma, fake news can spread 6 times faster than true news. So I wish it were not the case that it was here to stay. I think we need a much more culturally immune population that can not really just use critical thinking, but really recognize that this system is fundamentally not going to produce hearsay or rumors that are likely to be accurate.
And in 2021, it's going to be about vaccine information as well. Okay, so definitely unfinished.
Definitely unfinished. But yeah, the vaccine is going to be a big one. Okay, I've got one for you.
Okay.
Manoush. Privacy, is it finished or unfinished?
It is so unfinished, so unfinished. We are just getting started with privacy, particularly here in the United States. We saw 2 states, California and Michigan, pass new privacy regulation. It's interesting, like when I first started reporting on privacy stuff, people were like, what? I pay for free apps with my information? And now like everyone knows that. But they've also, like, they still feel disempowered, I think, consumers. And so we're at this regulation stage, which I think is going to get more interesting, more exciting. There's also projects that have been in the works, like Sir Tim Berners-Lee, his Solid project, just launched, like, for real this month, which is really exciting. And that's where you have your own personal data pods. So I feel like privacy, oh, it's so problematic, but it's unfinished, but there's some really exciting things coming down the pipeline. What do you think?
What worries me is the way that our minds are so seduced by the promise of certain rewards. And I know you know the example, I think it was about a year ago, of this app that went viral that said, if you upload a photo of your face, we'll show you what you'll look like when you're 80 years old. And it was actually a company that was based in St. Petersburg. And, you know, we can have all these data regulations that we want, but if all it takes is sort of showcasing our own vanity and our own social approval to get basically, I think it was something like hundreds of millions of people volunteered their photo to the St. Petersburg company to do this. It shows you that psychology might be more dominant than kind of data regulation and privacy, even though I want to be with you there on that one. Okay. Manoush, daydreaming, finished or unfinished?
Oh, so unfinished. I actually think that It was weird. The pandemic, when it happened, I got so many inquiries about the book that I wrote, which is about the attention economy, but also the power of mind wandering and how that works. And I think, you know, there's nothing like a change in your schedule, in your habits to sort of wake you up out of your stupor and rethink a lot of the ways that you are spending your time and your energy. And, you know, I think I hear from a lot of people who've discovered long walks, which is really an amazing thing. A lot of kids are bored because they have to be. And that, as I write about in my book, is not necessarily a bad thing. Daydreaming, it's back, man. It is back for sure. What do you think?
I agree with you. And I think that it's like the national park of the attention economy. We should reserve it and not let it be drilled upon and be made part of the commodification engine of these companies.
Agreed. Daydreaming is actually productive. So strange, but true. Ooh, this one's tricky, Tristan. Free will. Is free will unfinished? Or finished?
That's a very good one. I think about free will as kind of free-ish will. I think that there's a difference between how many dimensions of freedom do we have in a given choice-making environment. So, you know, someone who's in poverty has a limited set of menus that they can pick from. Someone who has a supercomputer pointed at their brain with, you know, it knows everything about you and you know nothing about the weaknesses that it's identified in your mind, that limits and narrows the degrees of freedom that we have in that moment. And I think the challenge that we have is that technology is going to get better at building that voodoo doll avatar model of us, not worse. It's going to predict more moves ahead down the chessboard, not fewer down the chessboard, like with Garry Kasparov, except in this case, the chessboard is our brain. And we're going to become more immersed and infused in technological environments, not less. Although, as we talked about with daydreaming, if we can reserve these national parks where screens are not infused with our lives, I think to the extent that we have free will or free-ish will, we can expand those dimensions with our time spent not in these environments and not on these screens. And so I don't think it's finished, but I do think that the deck is stacked increasingly against us if we don't wake up as a culture. How about you? What do you think?
Sadly, I'm with you on that. I think the only way to really exert your free will is to opt out right now. Even those of us who, you know, are writing about ideas, how do you get your ideas out there? You have to use the platforms that you are writing about that you hate. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the only way is to completely opt out. And can we not let's definitely say though that free will is not finished, right? Like,
we agree it's unfinished.
Okay, I'm up next to give you one. Tech for good. Is tech for good finished or unfinished?
It's definitely unfinished. I hope that, you know, all of the pressure and kind of cultural awakening that's been happening the last few years with people realizing so many of the harms of tech, which I hope don't disenchant people too much to technology overall, but allow them to recognize there's certain toxic business models that cause these ills, and that we don't have to have or associate technology with being harmful or evil. And, you know, I was just on a call actually with some parents talking about the social dilemma and, you know, should we let our kids use technology? And I made clear, you know, growing up, I'm on an iMac right now. And I think, you know, if we all had a big desktop computer for our kids where they could creatively come up with songs and music and programming and art and writing, you know, this is totally a tool that can be used for good. And I think we can have a whole industry and a whole set of incentives in which technology is really not in this predatory or manipulative business model with us. But for us to do that, we have to really question and regulate the business model that's based on this sort of influencing a slight imperceptible change in our attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors, which is what Jaron Lanier says is really the problem with the social media companies. But what do you think?
You know, this idea that technology is neutral is finished. Definitely. Like,
thank God.
Right? Hallelujah. I am usually an optimist, but I really think that tech for good is just getting started thanks to the pipeline that is being built.
Okay. Cancel culture. finished or unfinished?
We can't have a good debate over how we want our society to continue to hopefully flourish if we can't listen to each other and give each other the space to make mistakes or plead our case or all of those things. And so I think cancel culture, it has to be over, but I do also think that the people who've been calling it out, like that list in Harper's of people who said, you know, let's end the cancel culture, there's some people on that list who've had a lot of power and have gotten to say whatever they've wanted to say for a really long time. And at some point, you know what, maybe not cancel you, but can we just mute you a little bit, some of you people? So I think cancel culture is too simplistic. Let's finish it and let's be more nuanced about who has the power, how we have civic discourse, and how we continue to be a place where ideas are worth debating.
I agree. I think we need to call it finished if we care about our society being able to evolve. I think an entire culture that is based on hyper-monitoring with vigilance for any small mistake and using that to create a angrier and angrier mob who, with a shortening and shortening time horizon, have utter black and white certainty that you need to go. Having kids and teenagers in high school subject to that, the effect of that is that every kid is afraid and doesn't get the chance to grow and make mistakes. And that I think that what we really should value is a culture of conscious evolution, where we each have a space for growth, making mistakes, and also apologizing if we do make a mistake. But right now, the research shows that if a person actually makes a public apology, they'll do even worse because of the way social media is structured to build still a first, a bigger and bigger, angrier mob, that wasn't enough and why, you know, the person still deserves to be reprimanded and so on.
Which brings us back to the first thing that we talked about, which was fake news. And exactly right, that we can see clashes that happen online also translate into real life clashes, which let's hope we don't see more of that in 2021 as well.
I agree.
But on a positive note, this was so fun. Good to see you, my friend, even though it's over
really
Zoom.
Really good to see you, Manoush. Please be well. I know with the school shutdowns, I know it's a lot to hold. It's great to see you.
I got into coding because I wanted to do things that I couldn't do by myself. And being able to collaborate with machines meant that I could do things that I do poorly faster, and then I could do things that machines do poorly better. The first place I started performing was with my mom, who was a storyteller from the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. I would play the Iroquois rattle and drum while she told stories. I then became a classically trained opera singer. I started composing and directing and making more and more emerging technology mixed with live performance and opera, and kind of ended up in museums. Nowadays, I use a lot of different media. AR and VR are interactive media to tell stories, co-creating with other types of non-human systems. As an artist or as an activist, I look at the way that the Iroquois Confederacy was built. We said that anything that I'm doing now is the result of seven generations behind me. Anything I do will have a lasting impact on the seven generations ahead of me. We use stories as a way of taking values and ethics and putting them into the core of innovation. I started looking at the media landscape we have now. How do I take information and encode it for future generations? A lot of my work is really about creating an ethical framework for software development and design and articulation of values and ethics within technologies with the understanding that we need to future-proof these. There's a notion that the technology we've created now has outrun us. No one knows how to regulate it. We accidentally opened this Pandora's box and we can't get it all back inside. But actually, we can choose to use technology to build a more just world, a more equitable world. We can demand that. We can say that we want algorithms that are human-centered, that are for our environment, that are pro-democracy. We can articulate the values we want to see in technology and communicate those to seven generations in the future. What do we want to achieve with the culture and social network that we're creating?
I am so relieved that free will isn't finished and I need it to continue. Even if, like, I'm already in a simulation and the words emerging from my mouth right now are actually programmed by an all-seeing digital lord of some kind, I want to believe I still have free will. Thank you, Tristan, Manoush, and Amelia for helping us think in the very long term. And tech cycles that are about the next 7 days to think about the next seven generations is an act of beautiful rebellion. We just heard from Amelia, who participated in a partnership between Unfinished and the Civic Arts Organization Four Freedoms, where we asked artists to identify the biggest questions they have about our society and turn those questions into billboards all across the United States. Now, Amelia's billboard asks, what is made bright by the loss of your light? I mean, that's poetry right there. I'm gonna let you sit with that for a minute. And speaking of your light, I'm seeing some great responses in the chat on the way technology has changed your life. Here are a few. Jonathan Higgins, I see you. Thank you for being here. Jonathan says, tech helps me feel seen, but I wish I saw more of me, queer and Black, in it. Let's turn up the dial on you, Jonathan. Thank you for that. We've got Charlie Brown in the house. Just a moment of pause, reflection, excitement. Charlie Brown is here. And Charlie Brown shares that tech has offered exponential boost to my curiosity. For real. Yes. Robin says technology has made me intellectually fearless. And Carol Napolitano, I love your name, Carol, says, how do we have technology versus technology having us? Oh, flipping the script on us. Okay. Keep at it in the chat. Thank you so much. And let me see what you had to say about our daydreaming poll. Is daydreaming finished or unfinished? 97% of you said daydreaming is unfinished. 3% of you are bots. Sorry to reveal it to you. You are Cylons. That's just the nature of the revelation. Next up, we have a conversation between Andrew Yang. That's right. The former presidential candidate and leader of the Yang Gang, Andrew Yang himself, along with Vivian Schiller, the head of Aspen Digital at the Aspen Institute and the former head of news at Twitter. Let's see what tech policy Andrew is really passionate about. Then we'll get to a short film on Sharon Terry, who is also here. Hello, Sharon. I saw you in the chat. A short film on Sharon Terry, CEO of Genetic Alliance and an Ashoka Fellow, and an advocate for putting healthcare data ownership into the hands of the people it belongs to. We, the patients. Then we're going to have a film brought to us by an unfinished partner, The Shed, featuring Nadia Telekonikova, a member of the Russian group Pussy Riot. And I'm just so proud to have said Nadia Telekonikova without tripping over it. This story is about the way facial recognition technology impacts our lives and, teaser alert, how to escape it. And by the way, for my own analytics, there's some interesting things I've been able to learn about a few of you. Like, for example, 22.3% of you spend time looking at online real estate listings just so you can go somewhere, so you can pretend you can go somewhere. And I didn't need to hack into your computer to figure that out. I just know you that way. We don't know that much about you, which is why we try to get connected in the chat and learn as much as we can that way. What we do know about you is that Unfinished has attracted audiences from over 77 countries. That's pretty amazing. And we're all here right now together to get inspired about what's possible. So together, let's do that. Let's roll it.
Andrew Yang, thank you for being here. It is really a thrill and an honor to speak with you. So.
Oh, thanks, Vivian. It's great to be here.
Here we are. We're on the cusp of a new administration. I'm sorry it's not the Yang administration that you wanted, but it is a Democrat nonetheless. And so what are the key issues that the new administration, the Biden administration, should be focused on when it comes to issues of data and privacy?
I think the most pressing concern for the administration is how to help the economy recover, which you don't really think of as touching data and privacy, but it actually does. Because at this point, our data is getting sold and resold for tens of billions of dollars a year. And it's being sold to advertisers on social media in many instances. So we're having our democracy subverted, our mental health diminished, our ability to trust each other and objective fact reduced. So these issues are all tied together with an erosion of public trust. And I think that rebuilding that trust is going to be vital for the new administration to be able to accomplish its goals.
What do we do about a nation that is so divided and in many ways divided based on the information and the lies and disinformation they see spreading across social media.
Well, the tough part is that many people have found that it's both financially and politically to their advantage to go along with an alternate version of facts, an alternate version of reality. And that's one of the things that we have to try and address. Misinformation spreads 6 times more powerfully than fact. And so if you make a living spreading misinformation, then you're more likely to lean into it in this instance, rather than try and bring your viewers back to, for example, the fact that Donald Trump got fewer votes in Pennsylvania or Arizona or Georgia. And so we have to try and address what these incentives are and put some rules of the road in for what's considered news and for what can spread on social media in a way that reaches millions or tens of millions of Americans.
Well, and what do those rules look like? I mean, are we talking about regulating the platforms, regulating the news media? How does that manifest itself?
Well, right now you have Facebook operating under a 21-word clause of a law that was written in 1996, before
Section
they even existed.
Yeah,
Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. So if you imagine that DC has legislation in place to address these issues, of course it doesn't. They wrote a rule before anyone even knew that Facebook would ever exist. So what's required now is to modernize our approach to these platforms to try and get to the root of why misinformation is spreading so viscerally and powerfully, what the economic incentives are. There should be, at a minimum, an ad-free version of these platforms that people can opt into, because a lot of the economic power is tied to selling our data to advertisers. And so if you remove that as an incentive, then you can see the practices change on these platforms quite quickly.
Of course, though, what you're describing is the foundation of their business model itself.
Well, for Facebook, they now have something like 3 billion users worldwide. I mean, a significant chunk of their revenue comes from American users, but if you had an American ad-free version of Facebook, it would not it wouldn't turn them into a non-growth company, let's put it that way.
But maybe not the kind of exponential growth that their shareholders might like.
Yeah, you know, I mean, last I checked, they're worth $650 billion and growing. So, you know, like they can use a little bit of friction in their lives.
So one of the things that you recommended when you were running was the formation of a new federal government department, the Department of Attention Economy. What would that department do? And do you think, are you in conversation with the Biden administration? Do you think that there's a version of that that could come to pass?
I think it's imperative that we have something like a Department of the Attention Economy that gets into the guts of the design choices that these social media giants are making that are eroding the mental health of our children. Teenage girls in particular are seeing surges in anxiety and depression. I am in touch with the Biden administration generally. You know, I texted Kamala a congratulatory note not that long ago. But there are a number of things that I think we need to address as a country. And if they give me an opportunity to address something significant, I'll likely jump at it.
Oh, great. Well, we will look for that. And you're particularly focused. One of the things that was a huge part of your platform is about data ownership and taking data ownership and giving the people, the so-called users, otherwise known as the citizens or the public, control over the data that is collected by these tech companies, right?
Yes, thank you, California. You passed Prop 24. You made it so that people actually have data rights and protections in California. And if you are not in California, do you really want the people of California to have their data be safeguarded better than yours? Go to your state legislature and say, hey, you should adopt this too. Why do Californians have these rights and protections? They actually have a dedicated agency now to protect their data in California. Doesn't that sound cool? Don't you want that in Pennsylvania, New York, Washington, Michigan, wherever? And there's real money on the line. Facebook just paid $650 million for misuse of data to Illinois Facebook users. It's up to $400 a user. There's a lot of value in our data. And thanks to California, we're going to start seeing more of it actually reach people as opposed to all getting hoovered up by the tech companies.
Yeah. I am Andrew Yang and I approve this message.
Well, thank you. No, you know, I did run for president. I mean, you can't stick me into candidate mode and I'll get excited. But I'm genuinely really thrilled about Prop 24. Thank you, California. You did it.
As an individual, I am not a California citizen or a resident of California. But if I was, what does that mean for me exactly?
Now, all of a sudden, the tech companies have all of these obligations where your data is concerned. They have to audit it. They have to let you opt out of geo-targeting. They have to have more protections for minors. And if they fail in these regards, then there's a dedicated protection agency that exists just to make sure that they're complying. And this is a game changer. The tech companies didn't like it. Shocker.
Any other words for us about what's possible now when it comes to technology platforms and user data?
We have to face facts that the problems are getting bigger, not smaller. And so we need to rise to that challenge and also acknowledge that in many of these cases, market forces are cutting against us rather than for us. So you need a public sector that actually understands these issues at a deeper level. Congress has not had any independent guidance on technology-related issues since 1995, when they got rid of the Office of Technology Assessment. So it's time to modernize our approach to these issues, and hopefully there'll be some people watching this who want to lend a hand.
We will see and hope that there is more information and more help coming. Thank you, Andrew. It was really a pleasure to speak with you, and we will see you soon.
Thank you, Vivian. Excited to help inaugurate this platform. I love entrepreneurship generally. So, you know, I hear something new. Something new happens. Andrew Yang's into it.
The biggest question for me was how to help my children. So my kids were diagnosed in 1994, around Christmas, with a genetic condition, and there was no support for it, and there was no research being done on it. And as I started to build registries and biobanks and various data collection tools and so on, I started to see that that was true about more than just this one disease. I began to see that each of the little things I was doing for my disease, my kids' disease, was really important to lots of organizations, and started to build structures that would allow everybody to use platforms and registries and biobanks and tools that I was building. Right now, biomedical research is a wreck. People spend $1 billion on a drug that has a 95%, 96% failure rate, and only 4% of people in the United States participate in clinical trials. I say that's a pretty failed experiment. If I name a song, you can download it right now and have it in your ear a minute from now. If you do need a cab or a ride, you can call it up on your phone. If you do want something to eat right now, it'll be at your door in 25 minutes. That we don't have that kind of convenience or attention to what we need in the health arena is crazy to me. And so my desire is to essentially really change the economic models and the business models for how things are done. Right now, big pharma companies spend a lot of money finding individuals to participate in clinical trials. We don't need to do that. We can make people available in clinical trials as ubiquitous as songs on our smartphone. And people want to be involved. And at the same time, I am not a Pollyannish person saying, oh, we should get rid of the pharmaceutical companies or the big academic researchers. We need them. We want to work with them. But we really want them to be addressing what we as people want. So I think if we hold the data, they have to come to us. I believe that we need information from people that's pretty ordinary information about how people live, where they go to work, how they play, how they pray, and so on, and to be in the community with the individual in order to figure out their disease. So our system actually gives people a place to store the data, to be able to decide who's going to see these data, who's going to be able to use them. We're also giving the people ownership of this platform. So everyone who contributes data owns the platform. They receive shares, they're shareholders, and so they receive the benefit of whatever comes out of this platform because they own the platform. The data can't be sold. And if we can respect that people should control their own data and where it goes and how it flows, then we're really respecting individuals and communities and meeting their needs. I want and hope that people can start to realize that, in fact, their lived experience is the most important thing, not some arbitrary measure that somebody else made up, but each individual is the expert of their own experience. And that we do realize as communities that if we put all of our puzzle pieces together, we're going to be able to see the picture, we'll be able to make a difference, and that we will be able to change these paradigms.
The technology is getting better all the time.
Along with computing power getting greater, we're heading to the point where we, as a society, need to think about what we are comfortable with.
Artists and fashion designers have recently been creating a new form of art.
Camouflage art, which can be used to prevent computer vision algorithms from detecting faces.
This digital art technique combines makeup and hairstyling to help avoid automatic face detection.
Facial recognition technology
provide benefits in automation and security.
It is also a threat to privacy.
Sophisticated algorithms can already extract information about your gender, age, and even mood from a single image,
and then link those physical attributes to commercial or government databases.
With machine learning, the digital becomes independent for the first time. On the threshold of this new era, we must set a course for our digital society
to remain committed to fundamental values such as human dignity, freedom, democracy, equality, the rule of law, and human rights.
Every day, we quite literally face myriads of facial recognition tools available to the police departments and government agencies. Giving too much power to the police or any security agency provides the conditions for authoritarian abuse. Increasing mass surveillance could lead to the development of an electronic police state.
CV-Dazzle, or anti-surveillance makeup, is a cubist-inspired style of makeup using contrasts and shades of angular shapes. It was designed to trick surveillance systems to think that we are not humans. CV refers to computer vision. Dazzle references a style of camouflage using in World War I to disguise ships.
You want to obscure the natural highlights and shadows on your face.
The most effective way to do this is by doing strong lines across the face, mouth, and nose that divide up facial symmetry.
Partially obscure the ocular region.
The position and darkness of eyes is a key facial feature.
We exist under increasingly watchful eyes of both private companies and the state,
which, so far, we're doing whatever they please to use our sensitive personal data. It is reshaping our basic understanding of what does it mean to be a human.
I believe that is the next step in the development of the global civil society to organize in order to fight for bringing back the control over our data and our faces.
I so wanted to surprise you by coming back in a sort of asymmetric, insane clown posse, crazy face paint, but then I'd have to walk around with my face like that. And I'm just not ready for that level of commitment against Skynet. Maybe next week, not today for me. I also want to acknowledge Vivian Schiller is in the chat with us live. Thank you for being a part of that great conversation with Andrew Yang. I'm thinking maybe he could be data sovereignty officer of America, restoring data rights to we the people where they belong. Many more thoughts, but I want to keep this thing going, check in and hear what you had to say in terms of the results of our poll. Now, this question was, if you had ownership rights over your data, would you be willing to sell it for profit? 30% of you said yes, you would be. 70% said no. And I'm wondering if you're putting some preconditions for the no's, because I'm in the yes column, just personally speaking, because I'm already giving it away. And so I want some kind of compensation. But maybe you have a more sophisticated notion in mind. If you're not going to take money, what do you want in exchange for your data? We are about halfway through the show, and we've surfaced some of the unintended and occasionally intended negative consequences of technology, as well as the ways tech can be used for good. Now, as you know, Unfinished is all about the questions. We believe the act of asking questions is a powerful way to drive progress. So on that note, dear audience, I am wondering, what questions are urgent to ask if we want to reimagine technology? Throw your ideas for those questions in the chat. And as you ponder that, let's get into this in some more detail with a conversation between three people who really understand the impact of tech on humanity. And in particular, the ways our tools, platforms can deepen racism, sexism, and inequality. I'm pleased to introduce Meredith Whitaker, who is a distinguished research scientist at New York University and co-founder and co-director of the AI Now Institute. Meredith was also one of the architects of the Google walkouts. Remember back when 20,000 Google employees walked out to protest sexual harassment, discrimination, and systemic racism? You can find more information about those Google walkouts by using any search engine, really anyone. There's so many to choose from. You got your Yahoo, your Bings, your DuckDuckGoes, or you're just like type in a URL and hope it's the right one, which is my favorite search engine. Joining Meredith is Rashad Robinson, who is a civil rights leader and the president of Color of Change, the nation's largest online tech-powered racial justice organization. Color of Change was instrumental in organizing the Stop Hate for Profit advertising boycott of Facebook this summer, which saw the involvement of a lot of major brands in saying, we don't want to put our money behind that. Moderating this conversation is Ina Fried, who is the chief technology correspondent for Axios. Let's hear from them all.
Thanks so much. I'm really excited for this conversation. I think there's so much to get to. I'm curious because we're all kind of in positions I don't think we expected to be finding ourselves in. Let's say you had a minute to talk to your younger self and explain the problems in tech and how we got there. How would you describe what the issues are with the tech industry? And assuming you had a few seconds left over, what advice would you give your younger self?
I'll jump in and I'll just say, I would probably explain to my younger self that this is all about power. This is all about the concentration of wealth and power by a few that can make decisions that they're simply not qualified to make. And this is happens when a society doesn't have rules. And the advice that I would sort of give to my younger self is that we need to think about tech inside of the ways in which we think about our advocacy and civil rights work. Yes, there are nuances and contexts that relate to technology, but that, to be clear, just like the television, just like the telephone were tools that we could use to reach more people, amplify our actions, move our demands, it doesn't mean that those institutions should operate without rules.
Meredith, is it just about power?
It's all just about power, and I'm really vibing on Rashad's answer here. I think I would look at young Meredith and I would say, you know, don't be so tech-dazzled when they talk about innovation, when they talk about entrepreneurship, when you sit down and take those really boring programming classes. Those are not actually going to bring you as much closer to understanding the core of technology and the technology industry in late capitalism as looking around and understanding the political economy and the incentives that are driving these firms.
So one of the things we talk about a lot is, you know, it's really important to have the right people in the room. It's important that the community be represented. But how much is the people in the room influencing the issues of today versus other systemic problems beyond just the workforce composition?
You know, we say this a lot at Color of Change, is that we can't mistake presence for power. Visibility and awareness and being at the table doesn't substitute the ability to shape or change the rules, the written rules and the unwritten rules. And so, yes, it would be changed. Things would absolutely change in terms of if the room looked different. But, we're not looking, as my good friend Dorian Warren of Community Change says, we're not looking for rainbow oligarchy. And so if we end up with diversity for diversity's sake that doesn't actually change the nuances, the structures, the contours, and in particular the rules, then what we just do is we like paint diversity over a problematic structure, and Black and brown people can be just as complicit in these structures if we don't actually have rules that allow for the type of accountability that's necessary.
Yeah, what Rashad said. I mean, I've been in those rooms, right? Those aren't my rooms. I'm playing by their rules. And oftentimes, at least in my experience, it was very clear that, the few of us who were women and, the even fewer people who were Black women or women of color in those rooms, they often had the least power and were doing the most work, kind of diversity theater work, where we were there so they could say we're there.
So I think this may be the toughest question I could think of when I was trying to think up questions. What would a functional, healthy tech sector look like? What would it need to have? How would it operate? And what do we need to change to get there?
Most of these questions aren't questions of technology, right? We're talking about criminal justice. We're talking about questions of housing. We're talking about questions of education. We're talking about, you know, questions of medicine and medical racism and discrimination. These are all their own extraordinarily complex domains with their own histories, with their own sets of, you know, expertise. And what we have seen is we've seen, you know, technologies and technological solutionism be threaded through these domains in ways that are amplifying a lot of the pathologies of the tech industry. But I think, you know, first and foremost, we would have to recognize that, you know, understanding how to program or understanding how to train a neural net does not give you insight or purchase on most of these questions. In fact, you may be, you know, less well prepared because the type of education you get is extraordinarily narrow.
When I think about, you know, healthy industries, industries that provide us our food, right? There's an FDA that actually oversights and evaluates and has accountability and has certifications and all of the things that industries that are still allowed to thrive. People still make money. People still grow, but there's accountability. And these are not perfect industries. But what I'm saying is that until we actually have systems and structures that that force those who go into these industries to know that they just can't move fast and break things because they will break people and have to not be accountable for any of it, that things won't flourish. That we also have to think as a society, what are utilities and what are and public goods and what are not? And we have to be sort of conscious of those things. What are the sort of, you know, tools that everyone needs and in our society and that we should be providing to everyone? You know, I think that, you know, when I end up in the rooms at, you know, whether it's at the highest levels at Twitter or Facebook, it's like you're sitting across the table from someone that you're presenting all these problems to, and they're making a decision about whether or not they believe you or whether or not they're gonna do something about it, or whether or not it animates their attention. And they get to like sit back and play God without any accountability, without any consequences. When something really bad happens on their platform, what I get is doe eyes. I really care, Rashad. You know, like this, you know, when we heard the news, it really hit me here. And I know that like, that absolutely means nothing. When a corporation tells me that they feel something, it only matters if they feel it in their wallet. And to the extent that like, until we get new rules, we won't actually have a healthy system. And from there, a whole lot of other things can flow. Things can be built, but at the heart of it, they will be built with a vision of accountability for how they actually affect and impact people.
We haven't really talked about AI, and that's, I know, your specialty, Meredith. Why is it so important that we get things right? I think, you know, we talk about, you know, AI and computers as if they're these objective things, or in the popular culture, they sometimes get talked about that way. The way I look at it, and I'm curious if you see it the same, is, you know, the real potential is to automate bias. And how important is it to build fairness and transparency and accountability into these AI systems? And what's the risk if we don't?
Yeah, I want to draw on what Rashad said and sort of, you know, kind of focus on a quote by the inimitable Dr. Ruth Wilson Gilmore, where she puts it really clearly. Capitalism requires inequality. Racism enshrines it, right? And this gets back to there are winners from racism. There are winners from misogyny. These systems are not accidents. So I think we need to look at these systems. Of course, they are going to replicate, they are going to amplify, they are going to reflect the cultures and the incentives from which they came. This shouldn't surprise us. We look at AI and this myth of objectivity, you know, I think we need to recognize that that is a construction that has happened over the past decade or so, that is a story that's being told by tech companies about the capabilities of their vastly concentrated power, their vastly concentrated computational resources, their vastly concentrated data resources, and their monopolistic hold on the combination of resources that are required to make what are sort of, you know, data-centric computational technologies that they then sell as AI, as machine learning, as capable of all sorts of magical feats, which allows them to honor their capitalist incentives, which is to grow forever exponentially without end and enter as many markets as possible. So, yeah, I think it's urgent that we address that. But again, as Rashad said, and as you know, many of us have been saying, it's urgent that we address that as an issue of power and as an issue of inequality and not as an issue of sort of technical fixes for fairness or bias around the edges of these technologies that we take as a given.
Well, I'd love to keep this conversation going. Two fascinating people doing very important work. Thank you so much for taking part in the conversation, and thanks for watching.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I worked at a child welfare agency. I saw then how incredibly high the stakes are in government systems. And that's sort of what inspired me to start Code for America. I never was a technology optimist, but what I do believe is that technology mediates relationships. And if it's going to do that, it better do it well. It can be amazing to build a new app that people can use, or, you know, a new digital service that somebody can use to apply for benefits, for instance. That kind of technology totally can be transformative. But if you stop at the app and say, I made the app so my work is done, you really have not transformed the experience that people have. I think that the question of values that are built into a public service is the question. It is the fundamental question. The best illustration of that, I think, is clearing of criminal records. A project that Code for America did, where what is embedded in the current process is that even though you have a felony on your record that is literally no longer a crime, until you go through endless steps that take many months of paperwork and showing up in court and going to the police department, you're still a felon for all intents and purposes. There are 4,300 statutory limitations on your life if you have a felony record, and all those things continue to follow you around, except now with the work that Code for America has done on Clear My Record, where we say, it's not about streamlining the process. It's not about taking some of the questions off the form. It's at saying none of that is necessary. The burden should not be on the user. Let's just get it right. Let's just do it the way it should be done. And the great thing about that is it's way cheaper to administer. I mean, every kind of person in America can find something to love in that story. I just am in love with the future because I think there's so many wonderful people who are dedicated to it and can help each other get it done.
Second sticks. Ready?
I am Pedro Sepúlveda. I'm part of the collective Mil Metros Cuadrados.
We have been asking questions through question projects since 2014 in South America, the Caribbean, and Europe. And now we're working with Unfinish in America.
We always use one question, have like a dialogue with the stranger.
We're looking forward to see the questions you come up with.
We're a group of young filmmakers from RealWorks. And we got together to create one urgent question about technology.
In the morning when I wake up, the first thing I do is reach for my phone, generally.
Is it our undoing?
I think
yes.
So. I think definitely
it will be, eventually.
To me, technology is like the way that humans make the better out of themselves, through curiosity and trying to better our lives.
Obviously, there's a lot of good things about technology. It's bringing us closer together, especially during the pandemic, when we're all stuck inside of our houses.
I can't believe it.
Regular day, 10 a.m., just out here doing a few interviews.
And once 11 a.m. hit, we hear like crowds happening. We hear people screaming, chanting, and people are automatically pull out their phones to see what's happening. And I think that's what technology does. It captures a moment. It confirms a moment.
Trump got fired! Trump got fired!
The first thing that I did was call my mom when we heard the news.
From Indiana, and I know that technology plays a huge role on people that are stuck in small towns. I have parents who are extremely racist and who believe everything off of social media, which is wrong.
Too many people have a voice, but have a platform to say whatever they want and act like it's efficient. I think technology is a good thing, but it can end up being a bad thing.
I often struggle with the amount that I use my telephone, for example, and especially since things have switched online. So it's like, I wake up, computer for school, phone for this, computer for news, movies at night, like it's too much. Everybody here like pulled out their phones and were FaceTiming everyone. Seeing how technology connected everybody together and bringing everyone together for this amazing moment. At the end of the day, it brought everyone happiness.
I could listen to Rashad and Meredith and Ina keep going for a good long while. And I really appreciated Jen in that short film explaining the other possibilities for how we use tech and for whom. Who's the user we're trying to optimize for? And what does that optimization look like? We make some things really hard in this society that don't need to be. And the Real Works film, that made me want to be in New York on November 7th, 2020 again, just so I could walk around with my mouth open, catch some of that free champagne. I love free champagne. Now, I want to get into the questions you would ask to reimagine technology. The chat was really lit up. There was a lot to pull from here. David Grad says, just because we can, should we? It's a great question for all forms of power, including technological power. Melanie Edwards thinks we should be asking, how do we ensure algorithms are created by and for diverse individuals? That resonates with me deeply because I think we get algorithms imposed on us. And I love the idea of like grassroots algorithms that work for the needs that we declare, not that are handed to us. Alice says accessibility for individuals with disabilities in the digital space is also a civil right. Thank you, Alice. I saw a couple of comments about this. I've learned to be better about it myself, even as I put out videos on my own socials, making sure they're captioned, which actually just makes it more accessible to everyone, not just folks who are hearing impaired. So let's keep expanding the tent of who gets to take advantage of these or be tortured by them. And that would also include a lot of comments I saw about rural access to broadband. I think COVID has also exacerbated some of those deep chasms, and not everybody's able to work from home or school from home because that infrastructure is not in place, and that takes a lot of work. Now, as I watch tech natives learn to swipe while they're also learning to talk, I often think about the people who were born before the smartphone, before the computer, before the World Wide Web, and how they would make sense of this new world order. In this journey, we met Jerry Rosenblum just a few days ago. He's a 98-year-old influencer. And we're going to close today by meeting Jerry, hearing what the influential media artist Lynn Hirschman Leeson has to say about tech and humanity. And maybe if you play your cards right, if you stay active in this, I'll treat you to a rapping robot. It's not a metaphor. It's not like a weird, it's like an actual, just stick around.
I'm 98, I'll be 99 in January. I have 21,000 Instagram followers. It's great, my goodness. Everything is miniaturized now. See, your first radio, that was a piece of furniture that you put in the living room. It was 4 feet high and 3 feet wide. That's how far back I go. Well, I can't truthfully tell you that technology changed my life because I'm a klutz when it comes to technology. My friend bought me a book for seniors and dummies, you know, to figure out how to use a smartphone. See? My problem is that I thought about getting familiar with technology Only recently. I should have started 20 years ago. Should have bought myself a computer, take computer classes. It didn't appeal to me. When I see people sitting at these computers, you know, and the fingers are flying, and with the smartphones, the thumbs are going like this, see? It's, oh my God, how can they do that? They're a little too much absorbed with the tech. I worry when I drive along and I see somebody crossing, not even looking to see if a car's coming. That's a bit, if I fell now and I'm alone, and I got a smartphone, I can call 911. You see, my friend Katie lives in Denver now. She called me on my smartphone, and we were able to carry on a conversation and see each other. That's a big plus, my goodness.
Right now, we have a really powerful opportunity to invert some of the invisible toxins that are in cultural systems that have been weaponized against humanity. What's required now is to reshuffle the deck that we've been given. Let's draw three cards to shelter and protect the future. Technology has literally changed life itself.
So we've actually been able to print skin tissue and three-dimensional organs, such as the ear, for example. Let's say that a patient receives an injury that affects their skin. Maybe we can just scan that area of the injury, like with a regular scanner, just like you would scan a picture in a printer. But then you come back with a printer and actually print the cells right on the injured area.
My name is Luke Masella. I'm 19 years old, and I have a laboratory-grown bladder.
Remember clean water before it was contaminated? Each year, 502,000 people die from drinking unsafe water. The Weiss Institute at Harvard has invented the Aquapulse system, a portable purification system capable of processing contaminated water into drinkable water, 1 liter per minute. The 8.5 minutes that we watched George Floyd being murdered viralized globally. The virus of technology and connectivity helped to enable the Black Lives Matter movement, the Me Too movement, and many organizations dedicated to equality and justice. The stakes are higher now, so we're going to have to recut the deck. The next shuffle will require ethically designed and unbiased algorithms that create enlightened possibilities for digital autonomy, the protection of personal power, and the survival of the planet.
I'm Gil Weinberg, professor and director of the Center for Music Technology here at Georgia Tech. And behind me is Shimon, who is a robotic musician that is designed to listen to music, understand it, and then respond and improvise like no human can. Shimon has mechanical abilities that humans don't have yet. He has 8 arms, and he also has algorithms that humans don't use, such as genetic algorithms or fractals, or recently, deep learning. And the idea behind him is that he uses these mechanical abilities and algorithmic thinking to create music that humans will never create, to surprise us humans, to inspire us, to make us think about music in new ways and play music in new ways.
There may be music or a star into your mind. I clear this magic rules, cause I'm aware for you.
And recently we moved to hip-hop and rap battles. And again, here we trained it on lyrics datasets from hip-hop genre. And we worked with Dash Smith. And Shimon is listening to the rappers, pick up some keywords, and then looks at its dataset and its training and respond in a way that hopefully will surprise and inspire Dash.
Because I got the vocabulary off the top and I often rock, closing up shop.
Hey, with your false vision, social indigestion, ask attention. The solution is passing by. We are the servants of the world for the world's showing aim. Cause you're trying to make a claim. I want to be a human.
You want to be human, but you got to get a circulatory system. Plus, you got to get the soul and the wisdom in your brain to ascertain when we entertain.
Swallow the time I started.
It's cool and it's kind of different because working with artificial intelligence and working with Shimon, it's kind of like I'm actually teaching.
Facing along a magical song. Distance long.
Do I maybe feel a certain type of way about a 98-year-old being better at Instagram than me? Maybe I do. Maybe I'm willing to admit that to you real time right now. Honest to goodness, Jerry Rosenblum. Wow. Well done. Lynn Hirschman Leeson, thank you for sharing your artisticness and your vision with us. And to the robot, Shimon, just stop. Just cut it out. I don't know. I'm going to have nightmares about the creepy singing. It's not my thing. Maybe it's for you, but that's just not for me. And I kind of feel like robots don't need to do everything, including rap. We got enough bad human rappers out there. We don't need bad robot rappers. This has been a really great conversation. Amazing time. The time has flown. And I am really excited because I've been a part of this tech world for a very long time. And I see the types of voices who are in it climbing in terms of elevating the conversation, in terms of asking the deeper and tougher questions, and in pushing the bounds positively on what we can do with this. We've been talking algorithms, and I should mention to you the Algorithmic Justice League and a great movie called Coded Bias. There's stuff like that going on, and there's great questions that people like you have been asking in the chat. So let's keep forging ahead. Let's keep seeing this, as Melanie Edwards said in the chat, not technology as the solution, but as a tool, and make sure we use this power tool for good, and always question what that good even is. I want to thank everybody involved in making this episode possible. The partner organizations, the technical humans, the robots and the AI, and of course the simulation in which all of this is playing out. And obviously the guests who contributed so much. Most of all, I want to thank those of you who are with us live, chatting and participating from home or wherever you are right now. Thank you for your questions, for your comments, and for talking about the importance of the things that matter to you. And thanks for challenging each other. I've been checking you out. The capitalism, the size of the government, the liberal, the conservative. It's a really beautiful thing. And it's why we come together. We're not done yet, though. We have one more episode still to go. It's coming in 2 weeks. So tell your secret smart speaker, I won't say any of the names because I got that much love for you, to save the date, Tuesday, December 8th, where we will meet right back here. The topic, questions, culture, and change. It's going to be pretty amazing, as all of these have been, and we will have the chance to get in on all that with more guests, more videos, more performances, and of course, more me. For now, keep the conversation going. Stay in the chat, hang out. It doesn't shut down with the video stream. And head on over to unfinished.com and add your questions where we may get to them in 2 weeks. Thanks for being a part of what we're doing here, and I will see you next time through the wonders of technology.